Well, welcome back, everybody, from one coach to another. Helen Clitheroe last week. If you haven't listened to that, do go back and tune in. Great insights into what is arguably one of the, well, what is the leading professional group in the UK. I guess even comparing that to M11, the amount of medals they picked up at British Championships surpassed that of M11. So, yeah, credit to Team New Balance Manchester and Helen Clitheroe there. But this week, from one coach to another, as I mentioned, we have Justin Rinaldi on. Those of you who don't know who he is a very, very famous 800-meter coach. He's an Aussie. Did work with Josh Hoey for a little bit until they parted ways at the back end of last year. Currently coaches Mark English, Peter Bowl, people like that, and has a great approach to the 800. Gives a lot of insight into that event and the demands and the training. And you know, he is still a student of the sport. The way I'm sure there's people out there who have studied the sport just as much as he has, but I haven't met many because his insight, his knowledge and his statistics around 800 meter racing are truly fascinating. So this is a very traditional thing, early days Sunday podcast when we would really get into the nitty gritty with some famous episodes like that involve Renato Canova, and this reminded me of that. You know, it was a coach who really wanted to share his experiences and his knowledge, and so you get a lot of, I would say, value for money, but you guys listen for free, but you get a lot of value out of this one. So enjoy the episode, and we'll be back on Wednesday with a traditional sort of review of obviously the pre-classic, which is currently taking place this weekend, the Pursuit 5000. I'm up at Stirling at the moment, actually, as I just record this intro. And of course, we'll be reviewing everything that's happened over the last couple of weeks on top of those events. I mean, Femke Bol continues to impress. I think on PBs, she's probably the only athlete ever to have got a... She could technically go and run the 200 meters at the European Championship. She has the standard, and also run the 800 meters at the European Championship. So who has ever been capable of that? And plus, she could easily run the 400 and the four hurdles, right? So there could be a world, in Femke's world, where she could do four events at the European Championships, from the two all the way up to the 800. I guess Safan Hassan is a woman who has had a past of doing extremes, and I wonder if Femke will follow suit. Maybe that's wishful thinking, but seriously impressive what Femke Bol's doing. I do look at it though, and I think potentially this could be Femke's best season, just because of that speed that she still holds, and that is her strength, that is her advantage over everyone else. And if she continues to layer on that endurance, how much of that speed will she lose? What will be the trade-off? So I'm very excited to see, intrigued to see, I should say, how Femke develops over the coming years. But she's clearly got more to give this season. And now that European Championships is the 800 meters women's final is slowly becoming the event to watch, is it not? When you look, think of a world, I would just love Georgia to do a bit of a U-turn, Georgia Hunter-Bell, and decide, you know what, the 800 is the gold medal that I want. It is the one everyone's going to care about come Birmingham, come those European Championships. And there's a final with Keeley, Georgia, Vera and Femke Bol, plus Borgoyne, who ran 156, Renaud Lamotte is 156. I mean, it could be staggering. It could be something very, very special. But I think Georgia will go for the 1500. Let's see. But Oz obviously has a good record against Keeley at major championships when it comes to the 800, going off of last year. So I wonder how that rivalry will unfold at M11. And I wonder how Keeley will respond to the likes of Vera and Femke Bol this weekend in the pre-classic. Will she, in the past, Eugene has been kind to Keeley. She's run very, very fast there. And she's won there as well. So will she produce that 153? I feel like she almost needs to, in order to remind the world that she's number one. So it's going to be very interesting. Bit of sad news, actually, when we go to the Pan Across the England champs. Just looking on social media and some of the results, just two men in the senior men's 1500 meter final. The England champs seems to be on its knees, which is a real shame. I think we mention it every year, but this is particularly a bad year in the blue ribbon event of our sport, the 1500, the event we have so much depth in. Only two men line up for the 1500 final. So we'll be talking about that on Wednesday as well. And then obviously, good luck to the boys out in Mexico. I'll be racing back from Scotland to catch that. But look, that's enough of me waffling on. I think there's lots of news. I can't wait to get Lund back so we can bounce off each other and get chatting away again from Wednesday. But for today, enjoy Justin Rinaldi. It's a great episode, and it is a pure middle distance treat. Well, everybody, if you're a middle distance runner, this is going to be a cracking episode. The episode for you, I have no doubts. We welcome the amazing Justin Rinaldi with us today. And Justin, firstly, thank you for coming on. Secondly, do you just want to introduce who you currently work with? You're a famous coach in the middle distance landscape, specifically the 800. But yeah, where you're based and who you currently work with in the mid-distance scene.
Firstly, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. I've listened to all your podcasts. And it's a bit of a surreal moment to be here. But who am I working with currently? So from the UK, I've got Tieran Corcoran, who's actually injured at the moment and was going very well. Unfortunately, just suffered a foot injury in his first race in LA. Mark English, who's Irish, which is, I guess, the joke that's always made. Peter Boll, who's run 142.55. I've got Tony Van Dippen, who's run 144.1 and also 44.1 on a relay. Bob Abdul-Abdurrahman, who's run 144.2. He's just a 20-year-old. And then a few other athletes there. So it's quite a small group, but quite a good 800-meter group. And as you probably guessed, I only coached the 800 event. So it's all 800 meters.
Yeah, and I've got to ask why. Why have you committed just to the 800? There's a lot of similarities between the 8 and the 15. We see distance coaches work with athletes of all distances. Why did you decide just to commit to that one event?
Yeah, I think it was just out of by default. Like, I ran 800s when I was an athlete back in the 90s. You know, I ran 147 and 340, and I was an 8:15 runner. But the first athlete I coached, Alex Rowe, I started working with him when he was 15 back in 2008, 2009. He was an 800 meter runner and he ended up running 144.40. And then I just sort of, I've always loved the event and I fell in love with coaching the event. I was working full time in a bank. I worked there for 25 years. So similar to the setup to the coaches have in the UK, I had limited time. You know, I worked full time and then went to training after work. And I just felt if I was going to be the best coach, I had to focus on one event. So I have coached. You know, Josh Hurry ran 3:29 last year. I've coached a guy who's run 8:20 in the steeple, so I can coach other events. But my passion and my focus is just on the 800.
What is it you love about the two lapper then?
What is there not to love? It's such an exciting event. Like, there's so many different ways to train for the event. I know we're going to get into my training philosophies, but it doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean it's 100% right. It's just what works for me and my athletes. But, you know, people can come from the 4.8N, pure 800-meter runners, or 8:15, or 15 guys stepping down like we see Neil Larros doing lately. So it's just an exciting event, and I want to try crack. I think there's a perfect way to train for the event, and I just want to find it. I want to be the first person to crack that nut and think, this is how you train for the 800. I'm probably going on an impossible journey, but I'll try to get there.
I love that as a goal, though. As a coach, that's that. I guess that is the goal. And I mean, have you been surprised over since you started coaching? You mentioned coaching Roe there all those years ago, even from your days running. Have you been surprised how many, you mentioned all the different ways to train for the 800, how successful people have been whilst training very, very differently?
Yeah, it's frustrating as a coach because just when you think you've figured it out, you see how another person's training and you think, damn, That's completely different to what I'm doing. Am I doing it wrong? And that's why I like sharing my ideas, because everything I've learned has come from someone else. You know, I've got nothing unique about my training. Maybe the way I package it together is a little bit unique. When I first started, it was. But everything I do is borrowed from someone else. There's no secret workouts that we do. You know, everyone's read the Peter Koh books and we steal workouts from that era, which is what, 50 years ago almost now.
Crazy. So,
yeah. And then, you know, there's the threshold stuff that's been quite popular over the last few years. And of course, you've got to look at that as a coach and see what you can do to leverage off that.
Yeah. And when you see these different approaches out there and you stumble across something new that someone else is doing, how do you, I guess, not let that impact you too quickly? And sort of how do you decide when to use it? When might be the right time to sort of adopt that method?
Yeah, we've got a really good exercise physiologist that works with Athletics Australia, and I speak to him probably twice a week and just bounce ideas off him because, you know, I don't have a strong science background. Like, I understand the science, but if I've got an expert in the field, why wouldn't I leverage off him? It's similar to when we're doing weight training, why wouldn't I leverage off a strength and conditioning coach so I can get the best advice from multiple people? So I just bounce ideas off him. You know, we've talked about double threshold. It's kind of hard because if you've got an athlete like Peter Bowl, for example, who runs 50 to 55Ks a week, can you do double threshold? Because a lot of those double threshold sessions are 20, 25K in volume, and that's half his weekly mileage. So I've got to think about it that way. But, yeah, I like looking at ideas and just seeing how I can borrow something from it to make my training a bit better.
Mm. So you bounce that off the physiologist to know when to sort of exercise that idea or how to bring it into practice.
Yeah, or how can we modify it to suit an 800-meter runner? And if you look at my athletes, we've got some general philosophies, but not all of them train the same way. You know, Mark English might be doing something completely different to Peter Bowl, for example, yet they're running the same event. So why I say I specialize in the 800, I still tackle it from different ends as well, depending on the athlete.
Well, let's get into the 800 then. That's good to understand a bit of your background. But firstly, I think my initial question is speed. The 800 is obviously an event which requires vast amounts of it. We had a great discussion with Kim McPhillips at back end of last year, his sort of breakout season. And it really sort of opened up our eyes. You can see how serious people are now taking that pure speed work on the circuit. And we're drifting away. You talk about Cohen, Ovette, and the way they would approach speed. And that's, we seem to have moved on from that a bit. So what's your approach to speed training and how important is it for, you know, in terms of your philosophy and the guys you work with?
Yeah, so we do, I mean, we call it Speed Monday because we do a speed workout session every Monday and we do it all year round. So, you know, you might have a three or four week break at the end of the season. And when you come back, we start with the speed session on the Monday. Our week runs from Monday to Sunday. Hmm. So the very first session you do back is a speed session. Obviously, the intensity would increase over a few weeks. But when I talk about speed, I talk about max velocity, max speed. So we're doing, you know, standing start, flat out 30 meter sprints all year round with, you know, a generous rest, you know, 3 or 4 minutes. Mm. When we first start back, we might start in flats, but then we put spikes on. So, you know, the one session that we do all year round in spikes is a speed session. We take a hit in the volume because it's probably only 1,000 meters or less, probably 800 meters worth of work. We do a 10-minute warm-up, 5-minute warm-down, so it's not a lot of volume on the day, but we get a lot out of that in terms of speed. And the reason we started it, I just found it weird that I spent, this is going me as an athlete, spent all summer trying to get as fast as I could, and then I finish my season, and then I start winter, and I go, you know, the polar opposite to it and get this massive base. And I just thought, I spent all summer trying to get this fast, why wouldn't I try maintain some of it? Mm. Obviously, I want to get fitter, but why wouldn't I maintain it so then next year I can start the season even faster? And also, the other benefit I found is that you rarely get injured if you're doing it all year round. You know, you hear those horror stories where someone chucks in some speed work, you know, 3 weeks out from nationals and they hurt their hamstring. But at the same time, like the first time you go for a 90-minute or two-hour run, you're so sore the next day. Or the first time you go to the gym, you're so sore. But you keep on doing it and your body gets accustomed to it. So that's why we do it year-round.
Is it the hardest thing to train and develop speed?
Yeah, it is. And sometimes it's a dead-end road. So I've tried with some athletes to, you know, improve their speed and it just, you can't do it. But, you know, I talk about a two-year period. So I give it 2 years and then we just try to tackle it some other way. But I just feel that if you're running fast and running with good mechanics, it's going to help you towards not only the front end of the race, but the back end. Because you look at these 800-meter races, they're getting out in 23.5 to 24.5. It's fast. And if your flat out 200 is 24, you're in trouble straight away. You know, I don't care how strong you are. If you're running flat out in the first 200, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You talk about that 2 year, you know, trying something for 2 years before you just accept not going to move the needle. Why do you reckon athletes struggle? Why some struggle to develop speed? Then you've clearly had an experience of that in the past. You've been working with someone, and then it's dead end road. They're not moving the needle when it comes to speed. But were you able to still get? Were you able to still improve them?
I talk about an athlete. I had Jeff Risley, who ran, you know, 1:44 back on 2008 or 9 or something like that, early 2000s. He made 4 Olympic teams. I started coaching him when he was 34, 35 years old, and he made his 4th Olympic team with me, and he ran his fastest time in 9 years with me, fastest 800. Wow. And he came from a distance background, running 130, 140 Ks a week. So when we first introduced our Speed Mondays, it was very foreign to him. But we persisted with it, and I saw massive improvements. So he went from running 148 at the start of the season, thinking that was all he could do, and then he ran 144 and qualified for the Olympics. So it took a while, but this is, you know, 8-9 months for an athlete who had come from a distance background for the previous 12 years leading into that. Mm. So if I had had more time with him, because he sort of retired after that, I definitely think I would have seen some improvement. But it's just changing the workouts, you know, whether we focus on max speed or we just work on efficiency at 800 meter pace. So doing repeat hundreds with a short rest, for example.
Yeah, because from reading around some of your practices, you really break the 800 down beyond just speed and endurance. And obviously, yep, an elite coach, you would expect that. But you tend to refer to different paces within the 800 itself. How do you break the event down with all those different speeds and areas of the event you train?
Yeah, so very basically, I look at the 800 as the first 200. And we want to make sure that athletes are fast enough so they can get out quick and near the front of the pack, but as efficiently as possible. So that's why we work on the max speed, because make that 24 second a lot more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Then you tend to see the middle 400 from, you know, from 200 to 600. If you look at the splits, they're fairly even. So we look at that as a different component of the 800. And then we talk about the last 200 from 600 to 800. And everyone knows that's the hardest part of the 800, and it's the hardest part to unlock. But we do different sessions or workouts around those three segments of the race. And I often talk to my athletes just to remember how you're feeling now. So we talk a lot about feeling rather than splits. So this is how you're going to feel in the middle 400 of the race. Or this is how you're going to feel when you're approaching 600. And just know how tired you are now in this session and how much effort you have to put in to run that 26-second last 200 in training. So when it gets to a race, it should come naturally, theoretically.
Mm. Yeah, and this leans into training that first lap of an 800 and training that second lap of an 800.
Yeah.
And the differences.
We have different sessions. So when I talk about, you know, examples of sessions we do, if we're working on that first 200, we do 10 200s with 2 minutes rest, and we try average 24.5 or 24.3. And we have a rolling start, not a massive rolling start, just a rolling start. I know there's a lot of debate about whether you should do standing starts or rolling starts. We do a standing start every Monday, and I figure that's enough standing starts for the week. Yeah. So if we can just get that comfortable 24.3 to 24.5 with 2 minutes rest, I feel that tackles the first 200. And then if we're talking about the last 200 of an 800, we might do 12 to 15 times 200 with 1 minute rest and try average, you know, 25.5 to 26. So they're similar sessions, you know, they're 200 meter sessions, but one's got half the recovery and slightly more volume, and the other one's a lot quicker. And they're typically the sessions we repeat. We don't repeat a lot of sessions, but they're the two that we do repeat quite often.
Mm. And the endurance work, the endurance side to the 800, how have you stumbled across? It looks like you're getting closer and closer to that sort of perfect model that you alluded to earlier on in the podcast. And you seem to have been quite creative in how you train endurance with 800 meter runners.
Yeah, I mean, we originally started with a typical, what a lot of groups do is the 6x1,000 meters off a minute rest. When I had Alex, who was 15, we started, you know, we started a minute 30 reps, and we progressed to 2 minutes, 2 minutes 30. 3 minutes, and eventually worked out we were doing 4x1 mile. That was our typical Saturday session, 4x1 mile off 2 minutes rest, and then 4x1 mile off 90 seconds rest. But when I look back at it now and I see what the threshold stuff people are doing now, I realize I was probably the typical old school, just try to run those mile or 1,000 meter reps as hard as you can and not worry about your lactics or anything like that. We didn't even know what lactics were back then. And now I've got a bit more thought about it, and we're doing a lot more volume. So instead of doing 6x1,000, we do 10x1,000, but we've slowed the pace right down. So we might run them in 3:10, 3:15 with the same minute rest. So I think that's the biggest change I've made in terms of my endurance, is that we're trying to get more volume at the slower pace. We're not taking blood lactates that often. And then if I've got a 4:8 guy or a guy like a Mark English, we might do multiple reps, you know, like we might do 40x300, for example. So we're trying to get the same volume. We're just tracking. Wow. We're just attacking it a different way. And it sounds like a lot, but when you look at the total volume, it's the same as doing 10 by 1,000 meters. Mm-hmm. It's just making it more manageable for those type of athletes who produce higher amounts of lactic.
Yeah, and I remember reading about that with Mark English. So, yeah, the sort of concept, the theory behind that is he can run 300s at 250k pace, 255k pace, whereas if he was to run for 3, 4, 5 minutes, he would have to slow that right down to 330 and it becomes less relevant for the 800.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly. And, you know, look at Mark or Tony Van Dippen, who can split 44 on a relay. I mean, Tony split 44-1-1 electronic, so it's a legitimate 44 relay split. Yeah, if I try to get him out with Peter Bowl to do 10 by 1,000 metres, he just can't do it. So we've got to make the workouts different for those two type of athletes, even though they're running the 800, because they've got different weapons.
It's seriously impressive what you've done with Mark English. How old is he now? But I know
he's 33. But, you know, it's a really good joint partnership with Mark, because Mark came to me with a lot of experience, a lot of his own ideas. Right. He didn't want a coach that was going to dictate that you have to do everything my way. He wanted someone who would work with him. And I like learning, so I would not want to work with an athlete that's achieved as much as Mark. I think what I brought to the table was a lot more about the tactics of the races and being confident that he could win races rather than running for third. We talked about winning races. I think that's the major change I made in his running rather than the training. We made some changes to his training. It's more around that. A lot of credit also needs to go to Mark for the input that he's had.
Yeah, and he is winning now. I mean, that Diamond League win early season as well, he's running faster than he's running PBs at the age of 33. Now, that is mightily impressive. For some people listening, it is a good, it's a big inspiration that you can run these PBs late into what used to be an age people would retire at.
Yeah, I mean, Mark's run 7 national records, I think, since he started with me. You know, some indoors, some outdoors, and running PBs, but more importantly, like you said, he was winning races last year. I think in the last 18 months, he's won more races on the circuit than he had in the previous 10 years before that. He's won a lot of national titles in Ireland. I think he's won 19. But on the upper end, you know, gold meets and diamond leagues, he hadn't won many of them. So that's more important than the
fast. And is that purely a sort of tactical change from you? It's sort of breaking the race down with him before. And so he's much more aware of how to win these races, and he's learned how to win those races through you. What did you change then? What did you have to make him aware of in races?
We talk about tactics and positioning. One of my strengths as a coach is that I take a lot of time understanding how each athlete in the field will run. So I spend a stupid amount of time watching 800-meter races. I'll go watch every national championships that I can find so I know how every athlete... You know, I remember back in 2023, I saw Marco Arop at his national championships in the heat, the way he ran, and he negative split at a 144. And I knew he was going to do that at the World Champs. I knew he was practicing just from watching that. So I just think that insight helps me when I'm talking to my athletes about what each athlete's going to do in the race and how we can leverage off that to try win. It's not always guaranteed you're going to win, but if you have some knowledge about how an athlete's going to run and how you can position yourself, it's going to help, in my opinion.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you studied, I listened to a great, I think it was just a seminar, actually a webinar that you gave with Australian Athletics, and you discussed about the change, the shift in 800-meter racing around that 2023-2024 era when we started to see more and more men run 141, you know, 5 or 6 men a year running 141, and then a whole host running 142. And so our national records were getting obliterated.
Yeah.
What was that shift from a Rhodesia era to then having, there was a bit of a lull sort of pre the pandemic, and then coming out of that pandemic, there seemed to be a bit of a shift in 800-meter racing.
Yeah, I did a lot of soul searching because I thought I was this great 800-meter coach. And then everyone, you know, we were running 144s and we were at the pointy end of races, and then everyone just made this massive jump. And I took it to heart. So I went down and just looked at every sub-142 race and did every 200-meter split. So I had to go watch a lot of videos because not every split was available. So I looked at, I think there was 29 sub-142s, and I looked at every 200-meter split. And the major change in 2024 was that the first 200 was actually slower than previous years. So I found that the splits or the deviation between each 200 meters was a lot narrower than it was. And a classic example, you just look at Marco Arop in Paris. You know, Radisha, when he set the world record, went out in 23.5. Marco was 24.7 in the first 200 in Paris. So he's 1.2 seconds behind in the first 200. And then at 400, he was only 0.6 behind. At 600, he was 0.5 behind. And with 100 to go, he was 0.4 behind. He died a little bit in the last 100. But I just think that shift of running the first 200 metres a little bit more conservative, it's only 0.5. It doesn't seem like much, but it's having a big difference in the last 200 of the race. So I think that's the major shift I've seen, is that the split's a lot more even.
With that, have you had to train differently off the back of that then? Knowing that that's how Diamond Leagues are being run, knowing that's how these championship races are being run now.
Yeah, definitely. And it's particularly around the first 200. And even the first 100, we talk about running. I think there was the old theory, and I don't know if you've heard this, but you got all this free energy for the first 50 metres.
Yeah.
And you might as well use it, utilise it, and just, you know, go balls to the wall for the first 50 metres. But I just find that the 800 metre guys are not as efficient as the sprinters are, particularly the 400 metre runners. And running that hard in the first 50 metres just used so much energy because they were so inefficient, that it was just wasted. So we talk about running the first 200 as evenly as possible. So when I talked before about those 10 200s that we do off 2 minutes, we try to run them really even splits. You know, we try to run 12-12, not 11-13. So, yeah, that's the main change in the training. And even Peter Ball this year, during our domestic season, he ran a 4x4, and we tried to run 23-2, 23-2. And he ran that. He ran 23-3 and 23-2. For a 46.5 split, but we tried to do it as evenly as possible, just to practice things like that. And the thing is, you just got to practice. That's all it is. It's just practice, and hopefully on race day it comes naturally.
Does positioning become even more important over that first two? Now that we have seen those first, and I think Wave Lights are a little bit responsible for this, but now we've seen that first 200. Be run in a little bit more of a controlled fashion, the splits getting closer and closer together over the course of the 800 positioning. It looks, just from the eye when we're watching these Diamond Leagues, so much harder for people to get round one another with 250 to go, 150 to go, 100 to go, because everyone is actually pacing it properly. No one's fading like they used to.
No. Yeah, we don't have those guys going out in 23.5 and stretching the field out and allowing you to find a position quite comfortably, and then picking them off because they've gone too hard. You know, like Marco was 24-7, like I said, and everyone was there. You know, there's 11 athletes there at 24-7 because they can all run that quite comfortably. And that's why we saw a fall. So it's tricky because you'd hope that, you know, you'd only have 10 people in a Diamond League race. But I've got athletes who are on the, you know, upper edge of that 10. So I'm happy when they put 13 in the field because I get guys in there. But what we've seen, though, we've seen in, you know, 2024 Olympics and 2025 World Championships, we've seen really fast races, 141 in both of them, because the fields are eight, you know, and everyone can stay close together and all run well. You know, McPhillips was last with 200 metres to go at the World Champs, but he wasn't out of it, and he finished fourth, almost got a medal. So I think the way the races are run, it gives everyone a better chance of actually winning.
Yeah. It's like you said, it's swings and roundabouts. Hey, sometimes it's great they have 12 in a race because you can get those on the edge, get the opportunity to run fast. And we have seen a few of the elites. I know Keely was speaking out about it the other week on one of her YouTube episodes about the frustration around 12-13 in the race. So I think those at the real top end are getting a bit frustrated because they're not able to practice that sort of semi-final scenario, that final scenario like perhaps they could. Where do you stand with all the world ranking points and the way that we are seeing a shift with world athletics seem to want to move away from the focus on times a little bit and focus on racing?
Yeah. Well, I like the idea of world rankings. I don't think the system's perfect at the moment because it doesn't mean anything. Like when we introduce athletes on the start line, the world ranking appears there on a small number.
Yeah.
But I know my eyes are looking at their PBs or season's best. I'm not looking at the world ranking. And that might be a mentality shift for all of us to get used to. But at the moment, like, we see someone run 141 and we're excited. We don't think, oh, they're, you know, that performance is 13,000 points plus 120 points bonus for winning the Diamond League. Wow, that's 14.20. We just look at the time. And I think our sport is just, we've got so much history in the sport that's about time, and so it's going to be hard to get away from it. But I do like the idea of saying, well, this is the number one ranked athlete in the world. But at the moment, it just doesn't mean that much, as it does like in tennis, for example.
Yeah. We're definitely not there yet. I've got to ask you, obviously, you're in France at the moment. You're in Bordeaux training out there with a few. But how do you coordinate? You have a lot of internationals on your roster. You're not just working with a small group in Australia. These are internationals of a very, very high level. I don't know many coaches out there who have actually pulled that off, to have created a successful environment remotely with a lot of athletes.
It's really difficult, and I wouldn't advise it. I don't think it's the perfect setup by far. I'm really committed, so you know, I try respond to every message as soon as I can. If I'm in Australia and Mark English is doing a hard session, you know, and it's 2:30 in the morning my time, I'll get up. So I'm there on the phone if he needs to message me halfway through the session. Wow. And give me updates. That's the commitment I make. It's not perfect. And that's why it was really difficult when I was working full time and getting up at 2 or 3 in the morning for these sessions. And that's why at the end of 2024, I sort of took a leap of faith and thought, I'll try to become a full-time coach and see if I'm a better coach. A, because I'll get more sleep. B, because I can spend more time with my family instead of disappearing at 3 in the morning and stuff like that. But it is difficult, because I think part of the art of coaching is being there. I think I'm a very positive person, and I think the energy I bring to training is always really positive, and it rubs off on the athletes. I think I've just been lucky to work with some mature athletes. That's probably why I've got some older athletes like Mark English that I work with, and Tony Van Dippen, who's 30. Because they're a bit more mature. Would it work with a 19, 20-year-old? Maybe not.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting point. You made that commitment to go into full-time coaching. Do you wish you made it earlier? Do you think you'd be closer to finding that perfect recipe if you switched earlier on, or do you just think that was the right time in your life?
I think it was the right... I'll be honest, it was the right time financially. I could afford to take time off work. You know, if you took finances away from life, everyone would be a lot happier, I guess. it just wasn't realistic, because I don't earn much money out of my coaching. And I worked for the bank for 25 years, so I built up a good buffer. And it's allowed me, like, this three-year period that I can eat into my savings to try to become a better coach. So I'm trying to stretch it out to 2028 and sort of have that Olympic cycle and see if I can make it work. But it is difficult. I liked working. I had large teams at the bank. You know, I had 300 staff that reported up to me. Wow. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed going to work every day, and I do miss it. I miss that interaction with staff and leaders and developing ideas that way, because it's very much a solo mission when you're coaching. So I miss that side of it. So do I think I could have been a better coach? I have to say yes, because I'm always positive. I think, of course, if I started early, I'd be a much better coach. But we'll see.
And I guess the capacity to work with a number of athletes right now, it sounds like you're working with 8 or so, maybe 10 athletes.
8 or 9, yeah.
8 or 9. Do you feel you have capacity to work with more? Or is that, given the level they're at, is that all you can cope with?
Yeah, I think so. I was actually thinking about today when I was coming back from breakfast on the bus coming back to the house here, that I think I can open up my coaching and have like 2 different groups. So I have the senior group and then a junior group, because you know, when you're working full time, you tend to train at 5:30 p.m. like everyone does. But now that I'm a full time coach and I've got full time athletes, we can train at 10 o'clock, so it does free up the afternoons to maybe start coaching at a school level and developing more athletes, because I haven't got a lot of junior athletes. I've got a lot of senior, you know, quite old athletes. If they all retire at the end of the year, then I've got no athletes. So I've got to start thinking about the future too, and future-proofing myself against having no one.
Yeah. Hey, talking about the future, where do you think the 800 goes next in this year? It's bubbling away. It's not the blistering times yet that we've seen of 24 and 25, maybe because there's no championship. I know we've got the Euros and the World Ultimates and stuff, but it's been a funny year so far. But does that world record go in this year, next year, and potentially who do you think is most likely to get it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's bubbling along, but, you know, Marco ran 1:41 on the weekend. Yeah. I think Cooper will run 1:41 at Prefontaine on Friday night or Saturday our time.
Yeah.
And then suddenly we've got, you know, two guys running 141, so the season hots up pretty quickly. And then Emmanuel will come back and run probably 141 in London Diamond League, and then we're back in it. Will the world record go? I'd love to say yes. I'm just a little bit hesitant. Because if you look back at the history of the sport, the great athletes really only have a two-year window where they're really good. You know, look at Coe was sort of 79 to 81.
Yep.
You know, Rhodesia, that 2010 to 2012. Wilson Kipketer, 96, 97. So it's a real small window. And it's hard to see people improving. So maybe the guys that are running those low 141s have missed their window and had their 2 years at the top. Yeah. And they'll continue to run 141s, but they won't continue to improve. I don't know. I hope I'm wrong because I want to see someone run 139 because that would just be amazing. Sub 100 seconds. It would just be awesome. It's still a long way away. You know, Coe ran 141.7 50 years ago, and we've only improved by 0.8.
And why do you think that is? Because that is always like an age-old debate. Well, I'll have with people down the club, you know, we're in friends over a pint, and it's like, you know, as much as records have moved on in lots of the endurance events, and perhaps it is technology, in the 800, in the 1500, it hasn't really moved on.
No. Yeah, you're right. That 1500 world record's getting old too. Even with the improvement of shoes and bicarb, which everyone says is, what, 2 or 3 seconds. So our athletes today are terrible if you compare it to the past. I think with the sprint events and even the 800 that you can just train really hard. And I think in the 70s and 80s, they were training really hard. We're probably a little bit smarter about how we train now. But those guys like Crammy and Coe and Ovette, they were training really hard. And they pushed the limits of how hard you could train. So that's why I don't think we're seeing much of improvement, because I don't think you can train much harder than they did back then. You can train smarter, and the shoes allow you to do more volume and probably extend your career. But can we train harder than those guys trained? I doubt it. I'm sure if we saw some of Coe's sessions that he was doing back then and we got our athletes to do them today, they'd struggle to do them. You know, I know they talk about the 800s on the road, which are probably a little bit downhill, but I'm sure there's some really hard workouts that Coe did that were really hard that our athletes today couldn't do. So maybe we just reached the limit a while ago.
Yeah, quite possibly. And as much as the shoes, I think, like you said, allow them to train more, to get more volume and maybe extend careers, you don't seem to be making athletes too much faster in the 800 at the highest level when they're already mechanically, basically extremely efficient.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the shoes definitely help, you know, especially in the marathon and stuff like that, and the recovery from the training efforts and the race, they can do more marathons. And so the shoes definitely help, but I'm not so sure they help that much in the 8 and 15. And the results back that up. I know the depth has definitely got a lot better, but more people know how everyone's training now. So more people, you know, back in my day or in the 80s, you'd probably have to read a track and field news or a BMC news and get little snippets of training. Now any kid can go on YouTube or watch this podcast and learn how to train and be a great 800-meter runner. So it's a bit different, the world now.
No, it is. It is very, very different. Look, I've got to ask you about Hoey, because he was under you for a little while. What was that relationship like? I mean, we're talking there about who's going to break the world record. This is a man who we've seen do incredible things in the indoor campaign, obviously injured at the moment, so having a quiet summer. But what did you learn from him? I guess most importantly, working with an athlete of that caliber, what did you learn?
Yeah, I mean, Josh started with me in, November 2023, and he'd run 147 for 5 or 6 years and hadn't made any improvements. But when I looked at his results, I could see that he actually struggled to put a whole year together. He often got injured. He'd run two races and get injured, similar to he has this year. But he'd run two races and get injured and then try to run again at the end of the year. So he really struggled to be consistent in training. And then when I looked at his training, it was kind of, he either went to a real speed-based model or a real endurance-based model. And I felt with me, I blended the both together, and that's why he made the big improvements. You know, the thing I liked working with Josh, he was so driven. It was like having a wild horse that you just have to, like, hold the reins. And sometimes they might buck you off, and sometimes you can pull them back. Mm-hmm. But it's really good because, you know, I look at an athlete like Peter Boll, who's very relaxed, And he loves being a good runner, but it's not the most important thing to him. The most important thing to him is his family and having a good balance outside things. So he's not really driven to be the very best athlete in the world, whereas Josh Hoey was. He wanted to be a world record holder tomorrow and didn't want to, you know, he just did everything. So that's why I enjoyed working with him, because he was so driven. And I knew that if we could just temper that drive and spread it out over a 12-month period, then he'd run something really special. So it was good. You know, he went from 147 down to 142.01. And, you know, he ran 3:29.7. And he had a great season last year. We made a mistake at the US Trials, and it's the toughest trials in the world, and he came fourth. And that just spurred on his hunger, and he wanted to smash world records. And that's where we started butting heads a little bit, because I wanted to say, okay, I believe. We had a conversation about the indoor world record, and ironically, the goal that we both set was 142.5, and he ran 142.5. But I wanted him to go for the world record in late February indoors, and he wanted to go for it in December. And that's what we really butted heads on, was this: when to break a world record. And I know it sounds stupid, but that's really, we did have a falling out.
You know,
it's just that, look, you are so driven, that's what you want to do. I don't want to be the person standing in the way of you achieving what you want to achieve. I don't believe what you're doing is right. I think you're going to get injured, but I don't want to be the roadblock. So I had to let him go, because the worst thing anyone can do in life is hold you back, rightly or wrongly. If you believe you can do something, let them do that. And it was fun watching. It was so fun watching. Like, yeah. I was as excited as anyone else watching him run that 600 world record and 800-meter world record. But I knew the risk he was taking to do that.
That is a pretty brave thing to do as a coach, because you, in many ways, it's easy, you know, when your ego takes over as a coach, is like he's your sales pitch, right? Like he's the one who's probably going to make you more famous as well, make you more well known in the running sphere. So to sort of have the confidence in your and stick by your beliefs to let him go is, blimey, it's pretty admirable.
Well, I said the same thing. I said, I believe you can break the world record, but I don't want to take credit for it if it's based off what you're doing in training. Because he was, like, through that winter period, he was training very hard. Like, he was running fast. He was running 46-second reps over 400 in the middle of winter. So it was amazing. Like, but I also, as a coach and someone I wanted to learn, I didn't want to completely let go, because if this guy broke the world record, I want to know what he's doing, because I want athletes to break the world record. So it was catch 22 for me, I want to know what he was doing so I could leverage off that. But again, I didn't want to be the negative person, because I hate holding anyone back from achieving what they want to achieve. So, yeah.
And this just shows you how aligned athlete and coach have to be.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. You know, I had a typical example is Alex Rowe. So he ran 144.40 with me. You know, we made a lot of difficult decisions early in his career. And when he was in year 12, so his final year in high school, you know, he was the number two junior in the world. But I held him back from going to World Juniors, because I said school is more important than going to World Juniors. And it's around about leading up to exam times. Let's miss World Juniors so you go well in high school, and then we can focus on running fast after that. And then he went so well in high school, he ended up becoming a doctor. And that was the reason why he stopped running, because he went to med school, and literally he ran 145.3 the first race of the year. He started med school 2 weeks later and then never broke 147 again, or broke it once. But I found it really – I said to him, I found it really hard, because med school was very demanding in Australia. It's probably demanding everywhere. I can only talk about Australia. Very demanding. And I can't see how you're going to be the best athlete in the world over 800 – and do med school. And if I don't believe you can do both, then I'm not the right coach for you, because you need to believe. If you believe you can do it, then go through it. So that's how our coaching relationship ended. It wasn't because we had any disagreements about training. It was just that I didn't believe he could do both, and I wouldn't have been a person to hold him back.
Wow. Yeah. Something I'd love to ask you on is, you talk about Hoey racing probably too soon, getting injured, but it's negotiating heavy race periods for a lot of athletes. You know, when they're just all over Europe and they're racing, they're getting world ranking points, they're chasing qualifying times, trying to put themselves in the best position pre-national championships or in between nationals and the worlds and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's a very difficult period to get right. You talk about Hoey getting it wrong at the trials as well. How do you negotiate those heavy race periods as a coach?
Yeah, it's tricky. So just using Hoey as an example. So in 2024, he ran 143.80, but he couldn't, you know, he just broke onto the scene and couldn't get Diamond League races. And they were asking me, how can we get into these Diamond League races? So I said, well, the only way you can sort of force your way into them is if we run really well indoors. So we really targeted indoors, just a short indoor season. But, you know, he ran 143.28 or whatever it was and won world indoors. And that opened the door for him to get into Diamond League races. So we took it, we had to take a bit of a risk to get your way into there. But then the plan was to go back and do a bit of a base period after indoors and then start the season off in the Diamond Leagues later on. So it's just sometimes you've got to take a calculated risk because you're not at that level and you need to get there. Someone like Peter Bowl, we've got an Australian domestic season, which is in our summer and European winter. So what we do there is we try to run well in Australia, but we don't do it off a lot of 800 metre pure work. We probably do 3 or 4 pure 800 metre sessions during our domestic season because we know we're going to be better later on. So it's just pacing the season out over that length of time. My training is sort of similar year round. So if we find out we've got a race in 3 weeks' time, I know I can get you in a good shape in 3 weeks because we're doing speed work all year round and we're doing our endurance stuff all year round. And we do hills in winter on a Thursday, which is like a track session anyway. If you're doing 10 by 200-meter hills up a hill, you're just as lactic as you are on the track. So it's not really that difficult to get into shape. So, yeah, I think I'm lucky with my program. But, yeah, we do have a long-term plan. And sometimes you have to take risks by over-racing to force your way into some of these races.
Yeah.
If you do the top end, it's a lot easier. You can choose the races you want to do whenever you want.
Right. What's your, and a few people are asking me just to ask you actually, and I thought it was a pretty worthwhile question to put across. So typically from what you've seen, the guys you work with, what's like the recovery time after those hard eights, you know, not a season opener, but those really hard eights, you know, how long does it take to recover from and sort of go again? How do you sort of, what does the balance look like through the week before you go hard after a race, or what's the last time you go hard pre an 800 race as well?
Yeah, so if it's a championship race, it's 10 days before the championship, the final, so 10 days before the final. If it's early season, we might train hard. If you're racing on Saturday, we might train hard on Tuesday because you don't want to back off too much. You look at recently, so Pete Bowl ran in Stockholm and then Oslo, I think they were 4 days apart. So he ran Stockholm, ran 143.7, came fifth. We did a small workout after, but it was only 10 times a minute off 30 seconds rest. So we got a little bit more volume in there. And then we just went easy in the 3 days in between. So we didn't do anything. And then we raced again on, 4 days later. So it's just balancing. But then if we've got a major championship coming up and we know we've got 3 races in 4 days, we have to simulate in training. So if we're racing in Australia and we do a race, we might do a hard track session the next day just to say, well, this is how you're going to feel at a major championship. You've run 144, 143. You've got to come back the next day and do it again. So we do that sometimes in training as well just to simulate what you're going to feel like. I think the main important thing is not the training. It's just to show athletes that they can do it. You know, I've run hard in a race, and even though I feel like crap, I'll still be able to do it. Because I think that's some of the tough things is when you're warming up. I think I listened to Jake Whiteman talk about, well, maybe he told me directly, but he said he felt rubbish warming up for the World Champs final last year and didn't know how he was going to get around, and then he almost won it. So yeah. I like stories like that because I can take that back to my athletes and say, Jake Whiteman felt like rubbish warming up and he almost won the World Championships, so don't worry about how you feel today.
Yeah. Look, you clearly are so invested in the 800. We started this podcast, you know, that's the event you wanted to commit to. That's the event you wanted to coach at.
Yeah.
Do you see a world where you take that same investment to another event at, you know, much like the athletes move up through the distances? Do you see a world where you move up through the distances and you take, you know, that sort of that same approach, that same commitment to the 1500, let's say?
Yeah, I think, like, I'd like to progress to the 1500. It's funny because, like, if you're a hurdles coach, and you're just coaching hurdlers, no one would question it. They say, oh, you're a hurdles coach. But when you say you're doing the 800, they typically question it. Why are you just doing one event? Well, 800 is one event. But yeah, I think I'd like to broaden my coaching ability and coach out. Like I said, Josh ran 3:29, so I know I can coach a sub 3:30 runner, but can I coach a 3:26 runner? That's a challenge for me too. Mm. It's hard though, because I want to coach an Olympic gold medalist and a world record holder in the 800. Like, that's my goal. And I've never said to myself, I want to coach a gold medalist in the 1500 or the world record in the 1500. It's always been the 800. So, and I don't coach any females at the moment too. So I could, you know, stretch out to the female event too. And that's the one way I could tackle it. Like, I was coaching a steeplechaser and we wanted to practice the water jump one day. I moved him up from the 800 to the steeple because I thought that was going to be his best event. And then I went to fill the steeplechase up. I didn't realize it took like 90 minutes to fill that damn water bit up. After that, I said, I'm not coaching the steeplechase anymore. I thought it would just fill up in like 5 minutes. Yeah. I was so naive. And I swear that's what burned me from coaching the steeplechase, was just filling up that water jump. I just think it's hard. I just love watching 800-meter races and working out the tactics that way. I can't imagine me watching, even though I watch every Diamond League and watch every race anyway, I can't imagine me going back and watching replays of the 5K, for example, and seeing how everyone made moves, like how do they get to the front and stuff like that.
Look, you're going to influence many people, I'm sure, listening to this podcast and how they shape training and perhaps, inspire them to start the 800 and race this event. But who has influenced you the most through your career?
Yeah, it's just, there's so many coaches that I've spoken to. Like, even I remember, so I was 18 years old and Seb Coe was training in Melbourne. He was doing 10 300s off 100 jog. And I remember just asking if I could jump in with one of the reps, you know, and he had no idea who I was. And I just jumped in and did with that. And then similar when Kim McDonald in the late 90s used to bring his Kenyans out to Australia, I would go to their training and just ask if I could jump in and learn from what Kim McDonald was doing. And the big thing I learned from Kim is that the workouts were no different to what I was doing. He was just setting the bar a lot higher. I remember we were doing 1,800 4400s with Kim McDonald's group. And in my head, I thought, oh, we're going to run 2:30, 2 minutes, and then 60s. I don't know why, but that was just in my head. And I remember going up to the start line, we're sort of moving up slowly to the start line, and Kim said to Samuel and get one of the Kenyans, take them through a 150, and then we just took off. And I was running around the first lap just trying to figure out what 150 meant in my head. And then we ran 2:18.8, well, I ran 2:18.8. And I just would never have thought about doing that in a training session. And so what I learned from Kim McDonald was that if you want to run fast, you've got to lift the bar in training and just, you know, set your sights really high. But yeah, other coaches I speak to, you know, Trevor Painter, I watched him warm up with Keeley before the Olympics, you know, the heat semi-final and final. I didn't ask any questions, I just asked if I could watch. And the one thing I learned from them is they did everything exactly the same for the heat, semi and final. They didn't change their routine once. And that was a big takeaway I took from that Olympics, just watching Keeley warm up. I watched other athletes warm up and they're changing the warm up between the heat and the final. And they don't perform as well because they're not doing the same routine. So, yeah, every coach I've ever spoken to, I'm grateful. You know, I'm here in Bordeaux with Gabriel Tuao, and I sat with his coach, and we spent 3 hours going through the last 4 years of Gabriel's training, and it was refreshing because it's very similar to what I'm doing.
Right.
But just to have a coach who's coached a 141 guy, hear what he's doing, it's amazing. And so things like that, it's just amazing, yeah.
God, that does sound like the life, sitting down, chatting running for 4 hours. I mean, that'd be a killer podcast if you guys recorded that one.
Well, his English isn't great, so all these athletes were surprised that he could spend 4 hours talking to me. But when you're looking at numbers on a piece of paper, it's easy. It means the same. But yeah, it is. So yeah, I just appreciate, I ask a lot of coaches questions about why they do things. I've never been afraid of someone saying no to me. So I've asked you a question and you don't want to tell me. Oh, well, no big deal. But you'll find a lot of coaches and athletes are willing to share ideas, except Wilson Kipketer. So in 96, I saw Wilson Kipketer at the Rome Diamond League, and I asked him about his training, and he wouldn't tell me. The next day he was going for a run. I said, could I go with him? No, he wouldn't let me go with him. I said, what pace are you running? Wouldn't let me go with him. And then I saw him in Stockholm. So this is what, 30 years later, asked him again about his training, and he still wouldn't tell me. There's some athletes that won't share anything with you, and some are really open and transparent. So if you're a coach listening to this and I pester you for information, please answer.
Yeah, you know, I was in Copenhagen just last week. He's got a son, actually, who runs a 400. So I wonder if we'll see his son step up to the two-lap event soon.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. So Wilson was still adamant that he could run break 140. I think in 98 when he got malaria, he interestingly said, I know we talked a lot earlier about these even splits, but he felt that you have to explore the 48-second first lap. I know in Zurich that one year he went through like 48.3 around 140.
Right.
One low, but yeah, he felt that's where you can unlock the event. Where I believe it's a bit more even paced.
Yeah, a couple 49s there. One final question, actually, just on altitude and the practice of it being an 800 meter runner. I know some you won't see at altitude. I mean, you mentioned 2 hour. I'm not sure if he's that experienced with altitude. And some, you know, and even AROP doesn't seem to get up there much. But some obviously, you've got Wanyonyi, who lives up there. It's slightly different because he's Kenyan. Some Europeans rely on altitude to get them in shape at the start of the season. Where do you see altitude fitting for an 800-meter runner? Because it is so difficult to get those hard race-specific workouts in at altitude.
Yeah, it is difficult. I definitely think it's a positive for every 800-meter guy. Like Mark English has spent a lot of time up at altitude the last 2 years. He's actually in Sierra Nevada right now training at altitude. You know, Josh Hoey, the big breakthrough, he moved to Flagstaff after the 2024 season. They bought a house there and had a big breakthrough. Bryce Hoppel, you know, he had a breakthrough after moving to Flagstaff. I know there's examples of athletes that don't go to altitude and still run fast. But if you look at the majority of the top athletes, they all train at altitude. Getting the training right is difficult. So my belief is that you do your 800-meter pace sessions up at altitude, and then we come down for the threshold-type sessions because we're just not aerobically fit enough to do them at altitude. And then the pace gets so far away from your aerobic abilities that you're just wasting your time. So we might as well come down for the aerobic sessions and do the 800-meter sessions at altitude and just adjust the recoveries accordingly. So that's how we sort of tackle it.
Mm, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Hey, look, Justin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I wish you and the team best of luck this season as well.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, everyone.